This is the story of the one. As a maintenance specialist for university housing, he knows college students can major in wear and tear. Plus, housing so many students doesn't leave a lot of room to house all the supplies he needs. That's where Grainger comes in. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast, dependable delivery, Grainger carries the quality products he needs so he doesn't have to. From a new door hinge to a whole new faucet. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, this is Matt Tebbe, and you're listening to the Gravity Commons podcast. You'll notice, astute listener, that there is no fancy music. There's no intro with Christy and Ben. We're doing sort of an impromptu quick conversation here on November 7th. You'll be listening to this. It'll release as soon as we record it. We're a couple days away from the election, and I have been in conversation with friends online and in person about dealing with a second Donald Trump MAGA presidency term and all of the chaoses that creates for us, all of the complications and all the feels and the vibes that that brings up. So I thought, what better than to verbally process it with some really good friends of mine and of Gravity Commons. And so I've invited Timothy McCain, Mac McCarthy, and Juliet Liu to join us. We may have more people show up. It's like, there's an open door here. But I just want to say welcome, you three, to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Maybe we can start. See, I knew there was an open door. Here comes Seth. Hi, Seth. No, he's shaking his head. All right. Well, Seth, if you just want to sit silently and listen, and you can use maybe hand signals if you can't speak. Julia, I want to start with you. You're a pastor at Life on the Vine Community Church. You co-pastor with Suzanne. And your church is a small church in the Chicago suburbs. Talk to me a bit about how did the news of Donald Trump's presidency hit you personally? What were your first initial responses to that?
So for me, it's one of those things where I was bracing myself. To be sure, over this past year, I've been bracing myself for this reality, but still woke up feeling all of the shock and things like that, that you can still feel, even if you were expecting something to happen. I'm a mom of two teenage boys, and I think my initial response, even now, is just a feeling of protectiveness for them, and how do I accompany them through all of the emotions that they're feeling about this. So I am second generation Chinese and Vietnamese American. My kids are half Asian. They are old enough to remember that in 2016, all the rhetoric, all the anti-Asian rhetoric that started around 2020, had real impacts in their lives. Yeah. So that wasn't just like, yeah, that it bothers me that our president is speaking that way. It's that, yes, it bothers me. And I'm seeing the real impact of that in our lives, the way that people are emboldened in my children's lives to say certain things to them or to treat them a certain way. So they carry that memory with them. And for them, what was at stake in this election is, are we going to let this guy who from up front was leading our country into, heightened racism and just blatant disregard for people, is America going to let him back at the wheel? So I woke up Wednesday morning largely concerned with how do I walk with my children through this? Right. How do I help them make sense of what they're feeling? Because they have a lot of big emotions and a lot of big fears. And how do I say both something like, your grief and your anger are real and legitimate. And I'm here for you. And also, like, we never dehumanize anyone. And that includes the people who voted for Trump.
Okay.
So for me, that's sort of in some ways, it's been helpful to like have that mission of like, I'm going to accompany my children through this, because I haven't collapsed into sort of the grief or like the, I'm just going to stay in bed all day, which is, you know, a part of me wants to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, Julia. And Timothy and Mac and Seth, y'all can just jump in. I don't need to be interviewing you. This is just a combo. But one of the things you said that I hadn't thought about was like, I don't really have time to sort of sit in how I feel about this and sort of like spiral inward or spiral out, because I've got these dependents to take care of and they need me right now to be with them and for them, which I think, I don't know, I just want to reflect, Juliet, that like in crises, that's probably a helpful thing, like to get us moving, to keep us active. And then also over the long haul, there can be a cost to that too, that we, especially people who are in caregiving situations, teachers, social workers, counselors, pastors, that we're give parents, that we're giving care, and there's nowhere to receive it. It's a complicated nature of these things. Timothy, how about you, man? Were you surprised?
Man, listen, I'm a black man in America. I wish I was surprised, but I'm not. And that's the plight that many people found themselves in, is that we're tired of getting our hopes up. And and right now, even on, if you take a moment, just scroll through social media, you can just see the pain and the turmoil that people are experiencing. And where not only this feeling of like hope, but also this feeling of being used. And now you're having to take inventory to even more of the relationships around you. And these were efforts that was built post 2016. And you felt like you vetted the people around and things, and now you're back at the drawing board. So it's definitely challenging, man, to say the least. And I got pastor a church in here in DeLand, Florida, called the Mesa Community Church, and we're intentionally building a multi-ethnic and multicultural church. And so there's times where you never know who's going to come and sit at your table. And so having those dynamics, as even Juliet said earlier, not simply demonizing other individuals, but also protecting a space where those who are felt forgotten, overlooked, used, abused, those who are felt the sole of the boot of ignorant people, that this still can be a safe place for them to belong. It's challenging, right? And how do you build that, protect that, but also how do you be a need and a voice to community? So there's a lot going on. There's a lot to process. And I mean, you take a moment on social media, you can just see the black community as a whole going through this out loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard this from a friend last night on a Zoom call, black pastor from Louisville. He was like, I'm really angry with white Christians. And he said it in a Zoom room full of about 40 white Christians. And first of all, I was really appreciative that he said that to me. Secondly, I was really appreciative of the way that the white Christians just received it. Like, there was kind of this like understanding, like, yeah, we're kind of mad at us too. We get it, you know? I don't know, Mac, Timothy's talking about having a safe space for people. And one of the things that I keep hearing in a lot of sort of, speaking of white Christians, that, you know, there's already like a pivot to like, hey, it's time to heal. You know, Juliet mentioned we don't dehumanize image bearers. I think we all agree with that. I know you pastor a church, Mac, that has people that voted for Trump and people that voted for Harris. How do you navigate that as a pastor? What are some of the challenges that feel like are the places you're growing the most when it comes to that?
Yeah, we have the entire spectrum in our community. It's a diverse community, and we are located in perhaps more of a conservative county. So I would say that the geographic location of our community tends to trend a little bit more red. But we are a diverse community, I would say, politically. And so last night we had a group of people over at our house. And one of them is a minority and took all of yesterday off because he couldn't get out of bed and just sort of sat in the pain of what just happened. And so that represents one contingency or group of people who are really grieving the results. And then we have another group of people that see this result as a sign of God's saving grace for America. And both of those groups of people are present. And that is a diff. I'll just be honest. I don't think I have that completely figured out. I think I'm much better at engaging those people one-on-one in dialogue.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a lot more discernment on here's what this looks like to meet this person and empathize with them and at least perspective take, and then what it looks like to calibrate some degree of challenge. One-on-one, I have less certainty about how to do that, especially when other eyes are on me, because it heightens the sense of misinterpretation, of not seeing the deeper values I might be pivoting out of, to move towards someone, with humility and grace, but also a certain degree of conviction.
Yeah. I'm wondering what y'all think of this. I'm just going to throw it out like pretty blatant. I hear a lot of sort of, I'll call it like Kingdom of God, utopia, Shangri-La language around like the perfect church would have somebody who wears a Make America Great Again hat singing next to an undocumented migrant. I don't know if you guys hear this. Is this just me? I hear this as like, you know, you have a kingdom church when you have those two people standing next to each other. And I don't think that's good.
I think
somebody either disagree with me or tell me why you agree.
Well, I think that people have this understanding that in order for that to happen, then minorities needs to be silent. Mm. And that's been my experience. Again, it's just all throughout. I've been a black man in white churches for 20 years, traveling the world, traveling, preaching, all this other stuff. And I had no problem at all when they saw me as a black man, but till I had a black thought. That's where everything went to hell. Things went south. My bad.
I thought it would be Juliet. It would be the first one to drop the hell, but it was you, Timothy.
Lord have mercy. And so I think there's this figure fairy tale. There's a possibility for it to take place, but the work requires, it demands people to no longer think that unity will be solely legislated without them taking their individual responsibility and inventory to ask themselves a hard question. My thought is, if you have not unlearned your racism, how can you say you're not racist? And people aren't willing to do any level of introspection and work. So I think that kind of thing can happen, but we just got to stop. People got to stop being lazy, intellectually lazy. And so we can get to that place. That's what I'm dreaming of, but maybe I'm ignorant, but I'm hoping that something like that can happen.
I appreciate the question, Matt, because I think there's so many, like if you showed me a scene of someone wearing a MAGA hat next to an undocumented worker, and like, I would have so many questions about that, right? Like Timothy was saying, like, is that possible because someone is being kept silent? Hmm. Is someone being burdened with the responsibility of holding back how someone else's actions and speech and political views are impacting them? And that's how the unity is brought about. Or is there real, like, is there real truth being spoken? Are one person's actions and their impact being exposed for the harm that they're causing. Because that sounds like church to me. But the other one doesn't. And I appreciate the question, too, because I found it in my context at my church that over the years we have lost people, right? As we've stepped into naming things like white supremacist racism more boldly, as we've talked about advocating for the undocumented community in our suburb, we have lost families. And I wrestle with that as a pastor, because I wonder, is that some failure on my part to not convince them, please stay, there's a place for you here. But instead I've said, yeah, if you can't get on board with the new ways that Christ is reordering us, then this isn't a place for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Seth, I want to give you space to get in here. Because you had to download an app or something to even get in this call. We recognize the struggle. But I think it's important just to name Juliet and Timothy that, like, the unity that demands silence and voicelessness is a oppressive anti-kingdom unity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate you naming that, because I feel like so many of us operate out of colonial imaginations, mm-hmm. where we look at that picture that the 2024 Thomas Kincaid megachurch, picture. And we think that's the ideal. And I think it's really hard for a lot of people with privilege and power to understand that unity demands silence. And a black skin, to put it in your language, Timothy, without a black thought.
Yeah.
And I just appreciate you guys naming mm-hmm. that. Seth, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, can y'all hear me, by the way? Is this working? Great. Yeah, one of the first things that occurs to me is to put it in scriptural terms. It's a unity that doesn't discern the body. So this is a unity that, like, doesn't take Paul seriously. And yeah, 1 Corinthians 13. So this is at the root of, like, some of my dread, some of my disappointment is just, like, and some of, like, what I see going wrong, large scale, and that's just a lack of imagination for, like, what it means to embody God's political kingdom, a lack of political imagination. So when I see, like, a call for unity, you know, a MAGA person standing next to an undocumented immigrant, it's a lack of political imagination, which in scriptural terms is like an inability to discern the body. So 1 Corinthians 13, when Paul is talking about discerning the body before we come to the table, there's a false unity at work there that Paul is addressing. And he's inviting the type of discernment that is analyzing these power dynamics, oppressive power dynamics that y'all are naming about silence and speech. Somebody's speech is being privileged over others in their seat at the table. And Paul says that you're not living out unity. You're not living out the Lord's Supper. You're eating your death. And so that's what I think when I try to imagine that picture, like, I imagine us, like, just eating, worshiping unto death because we're not discerning the body. And the second thing, just really quick, is that, and I recognize I own that this comes from sort of an a priori conviction that I bring in. And that's that, like, for me, like, the MAGA architecture, like, intellectual architecture is inherently a supremacist architecture. And so, like, it can't abide not being centered. And so, like, what I've seen, part of my job is to, like, do research in congregations. And part of what I've seen in congregations, some congregations, is that there are people who, like, really long for, they'll say, someone on the other side of the spectrum, like a more, you might say, left-leaning congregation that really wants, they genuinely want more, like, conservative, politically-leaning people in their congregation. But what you see is that, like, conservative and even MAGA people just can't abide being in a room of difference.
And like you're saying, it requires silence.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that passage in 1 Corinthians 14, listener, that Seth is alluding to is a rich people. People who didn't have to work were getting to the church potluck before the poor people who had to work. And they were eating all the food that was for everyone, so that when the poor people showed up, there was nothing left to eat. And Paul said, you're not discerning the body, meaning you're taking care of your rights and freedoms and your needs, but you're not doing for the good of everyone else. And he says, the consequence is that poor people are getting sick and they're dying. And the second thing you said, Seth, and I'd love to hear everybody's response to this, is like, what do we do with difference? Like, I think there's a difference we all realize. Maybe talking about it on a spectrum, there's difference that doesn't have to divide and separate us, and it's over here. And then on the other side of the spectrum is difference that we can't abide, you know? And then I think that MAGA answers that question differently than non-MAGA. So MAGA can't abide certain differences that non-MAGA can, and vice versa. Do you guys agree with that? How do you understand that? How do you discern the difference that is like Christian diversity? And how do we discern difference that is actually doing damage to the body?
James Baldwin says, we can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. And I think bottom line, if the person coming at the table cannot see the other person as a human being, that's bare minimum. That is bar to the flow. That is, if you can't see the other person as a human being, then I don't know what kind of common ground that we can have. And
so can I dig into that a little bit?
Please.
I want everybody to dig in too. I know I'm speaking a lot, but I have a lot of people that voted MAGA in my life. I can't think of one of them who would sit across from the table of a Black person and say, I don't recognize your human dignity. So I'm wondering then, Timothy, what is it? Is most MAGA people self-report that they think that a Black person has dignity? How do you navigate? How do you delineate? How do you decide or discern what is dignifying? What would somebody not recognizing your humanity, what does that look like, and vice versa? You know, this is the whole thing. Like, most racists don't think they're racist. You know?
Yeah. Can I jump in here?
Yes.
What it makes me think of, I think we have similar things happening, like, just between men and women in the church, where men who might be committed to patriarchy or women who might be committed to patriarchy are like, it's not that I'm saying you're not fully human.
Yes.
But I also don't welcome you as an equal partner with me here in shaping.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to share power with you and give you a say in what happens to our community or what kind of a community we're building together. So I think for me, a lot of it is like, if we, I think as Christians, we have this weird thing. We want to be like, well, I don't harbor like ill will against you in my heart. I don't have like bad feelings about you. Therefore, like, I fulfilled the law of Christ. Like, that's what I love you because I just don't have active hostile feelings towards you. But I also like don't want you to have a say in what happens around here. And I don't think that there's much I can learn from you.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think part of that's part of the test is like, if you say that you recognize someone's full humanity, if you say that you believe someone is a full member of the family of God, then you have to be willing to share power with them. You have to be willing to give them the opportunity to bring their own voice and shape the community just as much as you think you deserve to be able to shape and build the community.
Yeah, that's the black skin without a black thought. That's the somebody has to stay silent in order for there to be unity.
Shut up and dribble.
Shut up and dribble. Unless you're Bosa. Or that kicker from the Chiefs.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody else has thoughts about as you think about your congregation, or you think about people in your life. What are some of the pressing needs that you feel like you have like proximity to as a result of this election? Or what are some of the important things that you're paying attention to now that maybe you weren't 48 hours earlier?
For I don't want to talk too much, so please chime in, y'all. Interrupt me, please. My wife is first generation. She's a first generation immigrant from Mexico, right? And went through process, all that stuff. And this whole mass deportation that's a big issue, rightly so. The progression of work from the stop and frisk and all that stuff, like these things have consequences. I have a conversation today with a board member, and our dream has always been as a church that we'll be able to at least partner with the Catholic charity agencies and other immigration lawyers like that, so we can be a place where we can give resource or we can give space, practical stuff, not just prayer requests, you know what I mean? Not just laying hands and stuff like that. But what can we practically do and who can we partner with? How can we be a hub to help people? There's going to have the collateral damage of ignorance. And so we were just talking to board member today about this. And so we're going to the drawing board in our next meeting of what can we do. And because here's the thing, we just planted in Easter. So we're brand spanking new in this area. Our money ain't long like that. And so we're going to figure it out, and we're going to hope that we can be a centering place for any people who wants to be in front of this. I think it's very important for us to plan to be in front of it, not chase it. And I think we'll be proactive in that. That's just a specific issue that immediately can affect. And we've already sensed in Florida, due to our governor, the repercussions of how immigrants and stuff are being treated. But yeah, so that's just one of a huge things with that. And even for the black community, man, I think just right now, the opportunity to not to know the answers and not to be the hero is paramount. And to heal, to feel, to rest, to recover. I think about the Elijah after the whole showdown in Mount Carmel, got news of Jezebel, ran in fear for his life. He was honest with the Lord, and I'm by myself, and he went to sleep. Nowhere do you see God rebuked him. He gave him something to eat. Angel Lord visit him, and there's bread and water and stuff like that. And that happened twice. I mean, he acknowledged. He said this battle was too much for you, right? Acknowledged his situation and went back to bed. And after he went to bed, felt his feelings, ate and drank. Then later he was led to the mountain. We heard the still quiet voice of the Lord. And I just think just even my community is like, hey, how can I have a church? And as a pastor, and as a person, how can I create space for messy recovery, right? Not answers, messy recovery. Take your capes off. Messy recovery. And then on that particular issue, and then as well as how can we address this massive deportation, which I tell you, people that's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Mac, what are you thinking as you navigate, you know, the idyllic, bucolic suburbs of Wisconsin?
Well, I think a big part of the work ahead is building on what we've been trying to do as a leadership team and as a staff, which is build conversational capacity. I mean, I just heard your thoughts, you guys, on how to be communities that where there's difference, but those differences aren't in an oppressive environment where we're shutting people down. And so a lot of the work we're doing as a community to build that conversational capacity is learning how to give permission for people to define themselves, and we're staying connected at the same time while trying to mutually submit to each other. And that just takes a lot of work and a lot of reps and to grow our capacity to do that well. And then I've shared before, I think one of the primary strategies that we're embracing as a community is to really focus on embodying God's politics locally. And so we have a lot of expressions of, I think, the politics of Jesus that are happening locally here that I'm just really excited about. And so it's super disorienting, I think, what's happening this week for a whole lot of people. And I'm there. But at the same time, I think we've got some really cool momentum that I'm excited to continue to build on, that I go, man, this is us working together to embody something that's uniquely Jesus-centered. And it gives me some drive. It gives me some grit and some determination to keep going.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most healthy coping mechanisms that I've learned from people who are doing the work that you're doing, Mac, is, you know, when you go to Project 2025, and you read through that manifesto, you can almost feel like you're suffocating under how big this vision is for things that I don't agree with, and how powerless I feel to do anything to stop it. It's like watching a hurricane on Weather Channel coming for your town, you know. But I think we have the closer we are, the more granular we get, the more local we focus, we actually have more and more agency and more power. And a lot of times the things like you're talking about, you didn't get into specifics, but a lot of the local Jesus politicky things actually aren't partisan. There's some things that of doing good for the common good that don't get co-opted into rhetorical propaganda, weaponized us. Like talking points, we can actually just get that grant to grow this food, to supply this food bank / food pantry, to help alleviate this food desert we're in, and also, you know, work with the community association to get the New York state owner of this Indianapolis strip mall to sell the freaking property so we can get a grocery store in this neighborhood. Like, you know, I think there's a whole host of people from all over political ideological spectrums who can do all that work, and there's no red hats needed, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. And it would be impossible for me. I do want to grow our conversational capacity to talk about political ideology and learn how to wrestle with that in light of the politics of Jesus. Absolutely. But for instance, we have like a racial peacemaking group. And we've over time started to partner with an organization in Milwaukee that renovates neighborhoods. And we have people who are across the map politically who it wouldn't go well if I just put them in a room and began talking about systemic racism. But together we're partnering and going to support an organization, and our lives are being colored. We're a fairly white, affluent community. And so now all of a sudden we're building friendships where otherwise it wouldn't happen. Eyes are being opened to things that I wouldn't be able to convince them of in a classroom, you know? And so it's the body of Christ working together and also being transformed in the process.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that. That really excites me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. How about the rest of y'all?
Yeah, I work mainly locally with people who are, I guess, somewhere on the spectrum of going through a spiritual crisis. So yesterday, one of my tasks was just to make sure that that people felt like they had a safe place to be validated and heard and seen. And I know that some of you also on this call have been doing that. So that was the work yesterday. One thing that I was thinking about personally yesterday that I was sort of just really struck with in a way that surprised me was whether or not I actually have the courage to continue to tell the truth. I've gotten some comments, some emails from people over the past 6 months that I've been too political. And I felt like I've done a pretty decent job of not moderating to the voices that want me to moderate. But yeah, I mean, I woke up yesterday thinking like, man, do I actually have the courage to keep going and to face, I mean, really the financial challenges that will come as I continue to tell the truth. Another thing that I think about is, in addition, you know, the people who are going through a spiritual crisis, some people, what they need is a safe place to know that I am with them, that other people are with them, and that Jesus is with them. But then there's another set of people going through a spiritual crisis who look more like me, you know, white, middle-class men, who are feeling the vortex, the tug of returning back to stasis, returning back to equilibrium. They just want to get back to a place where they feel good again. And so what I have been thinking about is, what does it look like to continue to cultivate what Martin Luther King Jr. called creative maladjustment, which is to normalize the feeling of not feeling good because injustice reigns.
Yes.
And then to cultivate a spirituality that knows how to continue to be present to yourself, to God and others, like when things don't feel good. So that's what I'm thinking about, is how to continue to make safe spaces for people, especially people on the underside, to have agency, and then continue to cultivate creative maladjustment among those who just want to return back to where things feel good.
That's a word, man.
Can I? This has been personally so encouraging for me to hear that there are other pastors and leaders attempting to have these conversations and lead these conversations, encourage these conversations. Because I've been just had the privilege and the great honor to have be on an episode that released on Election Day for Gravity Commons podcast. For my latest book called Honest Conversations. And it's literally, it's, I know y'all can't see those watching, right? It's Honest Conversations, an acronym standing for honoring, observant, nice, empathetic, sincere, and teachable. And the subtitle is Talking to Understand, Not to Win. And it's a super simple read. And the goal is to help, to encourage people to actually have conversations, conversations of discovery, conversations to where there is understanding, not, because right now it seems to be that there's so much yelling from soapboxes and just argument through social media posts. But I firmly believe that there's many people that if they will just have the opportunity to sit down and talk to somebody again and demystify the stereotypes that they have been narrated, where they have seen on movies or they have seen on or someone else's post or some conspiracy theory website or whatever, then there could be a beginning of a work. And so I know what it's, I'm still to this day, as I travel the nation, was the first time a white person ever sat down having a conversation with a black man. There are still places in this nation, where the only interaction someone has of a person of a different color, ethnic, you name it, is through what they watch on the news and they hear from a talking head. And I just think as pastors, as leaders, if we can help, whether you go the aspects we have in the book here or whatever, but just stewarding those moments and knowing that it will be messy, but it will be worth it. I think it could be a powerful thing. And so that's been really been my heart's cry. Like, God, how do I lead? Okay, I can speak from a platform, but how do I lead from the valley? And I swear that's really been my heart.
Yeah. I wonder then maybe something I've been just curious how you all handle is how to have a conversation when you realize that someone isn't operating in reality. Right? I mean, you know, when someone is just saying things that are just completely untrue. It's like, you know, a conspiracy theory, or it's not something that, it's just like you're looking at reality and the person you're talking to is living in a different world. Because I feel like I talk for a living. I mean, one of the things you could say about pastors is they talk for a living. And so I feel like I'm pretty good at talking and I'm pretty good at conversations. And I feel absolutely paralyzed when I'm talking to somebody who's not living in the same reality that I am. You know? And I wonder how you all handle that.
Again, y'all, I'm sorry. Y'all, please don't let me talk a lot. The reality is, Pastor Matt, they are. We live in America that has different Americas. And all of us are ambassadors trying to have conversations to someone else in this United Nation called America. My Black American experience to someone else who grew up in the Midwest of Indiana, in the cornfields of Indiana, is completely different. And so how I'm speaking passionately about my lived experience and trying to speak, hey, these type of policies is going to affect this way of life in me. And they're like, hey, well, these kind of policies are going to affect this life in me. That didn't make any sense. These kind of policies are going to affect my life in this way. And it's challenging. And so, because every person, and again, it's hard for me because I don't want to like say, well, their pain doesn't matter, because I'm not saying like there's things that are probably affecting them. And that's why I think until we can hack down this wall of ignorance and create a bridge of understanding, there will always be misinformation. And because, again, we live in different Americas. I hear this stuff. If you see stuff happening, people are like, this is not the America I know. And us Black people are like, where you been?
Yeah.
And like this whole notion, now you can see this really, 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 really apparent. When you doing this whole political election, you hear the phrase vote biblical values, right?
Yeah.
And but that blanket term preached in back in the day, vote biblical value was pro-segregation. Vote biblical values was pro-slavery. Vote biblical values was pro these things that now we look back and people will be appalled to say such a thing, but that's what it means. So because there's no nuance in conversations. Why? Because we live in different Americas. And until we really have these conversations, I don't think people's going to lower their drawbridge for truth, because they're going to stay in the castle of their ignorance because it's safe.
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring up there's two kinds of like dealing in different realities. One is like being misinformed, you know? I wasn't aware that, you know, Juliet, just for instance, I wasn't aware that like Asian Americans experienced the kind of racism or fear that Black people did. Like I have friends that are Black and they're really scared about MAGA, but I didn't realize that it was also scary for, you know, your teenage boys. Like that's a uninformed, and I'm learning something I didn't know, kind of dealing with two different realities. Then there's the, well, I'm just glad Trump is elected president because he's finally going to do something about the border. Well, hey, you know that the border was going to be secured and then Trump sabotaged it, right? So like he's actually the reason why there is no solution currently. And then when you say that, they say, well, every politician does that. And you say something like, well, he's going to fix the economy. And then you say, well, you know, the economy is, as a whole, is pretty dehumanizing. So it's really hard to flourish, right, in our political economy. But inflation is as low as it's been in years. and they just say, that's not true. Or you say, hey, you know, like Trump talks about tariffs or repealing the ACA or going to appoint RFK Jr. and he's going to take all the fluoride out of the water, et cetera. Fire everybody in the FDA. Like, this stuff would be really bad for people. And then they just say, that's not true. It's not going to happen. Or like, here's studies of what happened when this European country took all the fluoride out of their water. There was like a 600% increases in some diseases. And they say, I don't trust scientists. Like, I think that's the kind of different world that I'm talking about.
We had a conversation with our two older boys at dinner last night, and we ended up in Proverbs 26, where it talks about not answering a fool according to his folly, or you'll be like him. And then right after that, there's some nuance. It says, answer a fool according to his folly, or he'll be wise in his own eyes. And it feels like there's some discernment in these conversations to know what you're dealing with. And I don't always get that right, but I think in those moments where it feels like, man, I'm not sure it's wise to my shift is often to go from content to the dynamics, name the dynamics I'm experiencing. And and if that doesn't work, then I realize I might be engaging in a foolish way.
Yeah, interesting that. Can you give me an example of like naming the dynamic? What would that? Would it be something like somebody says to me, like somebody makes an assertion or says something, and I just say something like, I don't know what kind of work you're trying to do right now, or I don't know if I answered you, if it would actually change anything. Is that the kind of name dynamic you're talking about?
That's what I'm getting at, but it might also include naming how I'm experiencing the conversation. Hey, I'm noticing you're getting really big and interrupting me a lot, and I'm not sure how to continue when that's the dynamic.
Yeah.
I don't feel like you're hearing me right now. I'm doing my best to hear you. Is there a way we can pivot to be able to hear each other? So it can, you know, it's like a combination of observation, invitation, maybe naming my confusion, what I'm not understanding about how we're interacting or what they're trying to accomplish, you know?
Yeah.
But at the heart, it's going, hey, just focusing on content seems to be fruitless at this point because they're living in a different reality.
Yeah.
And then I try to shift to dynamic to see if that can prompt a pivot. If not, I'm not sure what to do after that, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if Seth and Juliet, if you have any thoughts about that.
This phrase has come to me over the past couple of days from, I think it's Aubrey Hendricks, Politics of Jesus. And one of the, you know, key elements he names of kingdom politics is take seriously the needs of the people.
Yes.
And something that I'm noticing in myself the past couple of days is kind of this Kairos moment of I think I'm actually pretty disconnected to a lot of the needs of the majority of Americans. You know, I look at these charts that have come out in the past couple of days about the huge percentage of Americans that would say they're just really discontent with their lives, right? That like life just, they don't have an analysis for it. All they know is like, life feels really hard. Like it's hard to pay for my groceries. It's hard to like make my healthcare payments. And like, you can talk at me about like policies that presidents are promising and things like that.
Yes.
But all I know is like, is my life is not easy right now. And I just need someone to make it better. Or someone, I just want to hear someone say they're going to make it better.
Yes.
And it's really easy for me to come in and kind of dismantle, like, but this president isn't actually going to do that for you and blah, blah, blah. And what about this? Look at this information. But what I'm not taking seriously is that there's a legitimate need that I think a lot of Americans feel because there's a lot of discontent. There is a lot of challenges in just making it from day to day. And so I'm trying to lean into that with more curiosity instead of the assumption that like you voted in the way you did because you are okay with the things that are being said and the policies that will be implemented. I'm trying to lean in with curiosity and see like, what is the need that you're feeling? Like, what is the discontent that you're feeling? Where is that coming from? Like, help me understand that more, because I'm feeling a little removed from it.
And I need
to understand it.
I would love to just comment there, because that's something I've been feeling in this conversation, connected to a lot of people who, some are working in politics. And I was talking to one of them earlier today, and he just named that there's this right track, wrong track phenomena. And 60 to 70% of Americans went into this election saying that we're on the wrong track. And so they don't like where things are going. And so I think, this is just me, but I think we need a thicker description as to the results, because yes, I think some of it is rooted in some of the racist overtones and undertones that have been named. But I think for a lot of people, they're just going, man, we're not heading in the right direction. I'm not convinced that Democratic policies, at least the way they were presented in this election, are going to produce the change that they were unconvinced that Kamala is going to bring about change. And they chose otherwise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think this is really helpful for me. I think that, you know, when, you know, I think one of the popular or famous like things J.D. Vance said was something about like paying $8 for a dozen eggs or something like that, right? And I think that the question, Juliet, you're getting at is that here's the median price for eggs in Ohio. You've never paid $8 for eggs. Versus, why is that so effective? It doesn't matter if he paid $8 or not, but he's channeling some kind of anger that is true.
Yeah.
Right. So what's true isn't the dollar amount. What's true is the emotion and energy under the statement.
Right.
And being curious about that rather than just correcting the false data. I think that's really helpful for me because I do like data and facts. And then also too, Mac, what I hear you saying is like, you know, one of the things you learn about when you begin to learn about white supremacy as a white person is that you just don't understand the ways in which white supremacy has compromised you. You don't understand how it works and how it impacts and embodies you. And so, yes, there's a lot of racial resentment in MAGA that I think pings off of that white supremacy that lives in our bodies that we operate sometimes unaware of, right? But also, there is a feeling of, I want things to be better for me. And this person is like emotionally connecting to that desire better than this other person.
I think so. I think people are wanting to see a change. I think that they're looking at 4 years ago going, yeah, my life is harder now. And I don't like it. I want something to change. Yeah. And this is just like standard. When you have an existing administration, politically, this just tends to happen, is the challenger is able to speak from a vision of change more so, that tends to captivate people. That's not like right or left. It just is.
Yeah.
Then another thing I would just say, and I have curiosity here, but I think there's something to it, and it's more of an observation, is it seems as though the party lines are shifting pretty dramatically. And it'll be interesting to me. I think that there's the Democratic Party. I think they're losing the average working person. I mean, at least the numbers would suggest that. And that just makes me really curious to go, okay, what is going on there? You know, I have a coworker who worked 10 years as a chief legal counsel for our governor, and she received a text today saying, from someone who's in their 60s who voted Democrat in every single election so far, but didn't this time, voted for Trump. And the reason why was because she said she doesn't believe Democrats are working for the working class anymore. She thinks that Trump's plans are better in bringing back jobs. And so I'm just naming, like, I think there are a lot of people who have legitimate, like, questions about why are the demographics shifting and changing? Why did Trump garner support from, right out from underneath the Democratic Party in some sense?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
And I think we need a thicker description to be able to name and get after some of the things that are transpiring in front of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's Bernie Sanders' take. I mean, what you're saying is Bernie Sanders' take. Go ahead, Julia.
And I think it's also true. Oh, I have to go on a little bit. It's also true that those people who are just voting for Trump because they need change, it's also true that they are at best minimizing his rhetoric, worst adopting and celebrating it. That's also true. But for me, I was thinking about like Maslow's hierarchy. And like, if you don't feel like your own basic needs are cared for, it's very difficult to care about other people or think about like your nation's identity. You know, like those are higher level things. And so I feel like if you had people speaking to and understanding, like, where are you feeling like you just your basic level needs aren't being met, that we'd have a lot more understanding for each other and maybe be able to make some progress together and being like, okay, let's talk about like every American having food security and every American having healthcare, uh-huh, things uh-huh. like that. But we're just talking past each other because we're on different levels of that pyramid.
Uh-huh. That's really helpful for me. I feel like I often don't know where to start to have conversations because we're just talking about two different realities, or I find myself not wanting to try to convince somebody that they don't care about women when they think they do. You know what I mean? Like that really is a gross place for me to be. So I do think though that this is helpful for me. I don't know if it's helpful for your best, but just starting with what their needs are, like where they feel like they're lacking, lack of security, lack of being able to provide, and then meeting them on that common ground to affirm and validate some of those anxieties. I think then my answer will be not to blame, an undocumented person from Mexico. but we can start with that anxiety or fear. Juliet, I know you got to run. Thanks for being with us.
You're guys, welcome. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, that's great. I don't know if last thoughts from any of you three before we take off.
Yeah, I have one. This is where the disconnect takes place. I think it is an absolute luxury and privilege to be in that position to where you can have these conversations.
Yeah.
People in my community, while we are people try to create a think piece in this moment, their hands are going to be bloody. They're going to be in the mud in the trenches. And you're doing funerals. You're trying to put families back together from the deportation and things of nature. I had a conversation today with the lady in Greensboro, North Carolina, who she's a doctor and she has a trauma practice. She said 2016 post was the busiest times of her life. And she's literally reworking her office to create space for the trauma that's going to be taking place, that people's going to have to relive and experience. So I think those kind of conversations, and it needs to have, I'm not throwing shade, but it needs to happen. But this is exact one of the reasons why Black people, they're taking their capes off. And because trying to figure out why sometimes racist will be racist. And at some point, you have to make a cognitive decision if you're aware and educated that the decision I'm making is affecting these people groups, and it doesn't matter because I'm still making it. And that's where many people are at. I'm not speaking for everybody, just my people group and the conversation of tone that's taking place. And that's why you see people all through social media, all through TikTok, I'm done. People talking about no longer call me person of color. I'm a black man, I'm a black woman, because this, you, her, and he, we're there for you. When the Gaza thing, we're there for you. When Asian America hate, we're there for you, and all this other stuff. But then at this particular moment, there's an exodus and a separation. So I just think, again, the as we all lead in the Americas that we reside in. And I feel like all of us hands can be the plow in different ways, but it is a massive luxury and a privilege to be in that position, that this will know the work you need to take. And I think if all of us coming together in some regard, I don't know, man, the future is going to be, I mean, he's Alpha Omega, beginning and the first and the last. I get that. But man, I just know we have our work cut out for us.
Yeah, I agree, Timothy. I feel like a lot of my sadness shocks. I mean, I'm not shocked. It confirms what I had wanted to forget.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's anticipatory grief. Like I'm sort of dreading the future.
Yeah.
Because I know what's coming. And that feels like it's like a train is going to hit something and I can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good word that we all have our personal work, and then we all have work that our demographic gives us access to better than others. And it's all meaningful, worthwhile work, but it's important to remember that it's different work. I think it's important. Yeah. Seth, you want to take us out of here?
I think there's an opportunity, and I don't say this, I'm not trying to, you know, end on a happy note. That's not what I'm trying to do, but just to say that there is work to be done that has to do with cultivating a thicker spirituality in the days ahead, especially for people who look like me.
You're using thicker as a metaphor, it's a metaphor. What do you mean by thicker?
I can't grow a mustache that thick, Seth. I mean, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, thicker means that it has the wherewithal to tend to and answer all of these deep, painful, complicated realities that we've been naming for the past hour. A spirituality that means that we don't either just have to double down to the, you know, to the cheap stuff that we had before and cover our eyes, which would be a privilege for someone like me, or to just completely give up. But a thicker one is one that is responsive to the brokenness and the complicatedness of everything that we just named. There's both a strategic, but also I'm just trying to name. We've been talking about strategy, you know, which is really important, but there's also just a deeply spiritual work that that needs to be done, especially for white evangelicals who, in some ways, are largely responsible for for allowing the creation of the kind of world that we're stepping into today.
Yeah.
The MAGA poltergeist. Yeah. Mac, Timothy, Seth, really appreciate you guys carving out some time on a Thursday afternoon to chat about this. I think we need to continue to just check in with each other. You know, it's really, really hard to be a pastor. And it's especially hard to be a pastor when all MAGA is breaking loose. And I just think I respect you guys, and I appreciate you and Juliet as well. And thanks for being willing to come on today and just chop it up a bit.
No. Thank you for creating a space.
Thanks, Matt.